Pop Festival in Berkshire. Paddington Station. Stevie boards the train while I search for somewhere to buy film. The train begins to pull out, so I start running down the indoor-outdoor six-track station. Porters and conductors screaming, "Stop!" Steve's hanging out the window yelling, "Come on, Dunk!" The train, gaining momentum just as I grab the rung of the speeding caboose, nearly jerks my arm off, but I swing up, precariously balanced, and then I'm on. I felt like Belmondo in That Man from Rio. Whew! Close call. Fiddly-dee, we're cats on a holiday. We disembark at Reading and join the crowd of hippies marching off to the festival. Ah, country air. August 11th. The bands begin to play. Pretty Things, Genesis, Curved Air, Mungo Jerry, who urge us all to get laid. We came unprepared for the cold nights, this being August after all. The first night, we sealed ourselves in a gigantic plastic bag, lying on the seams to capture our body heat, only to wake up an hour later to find our blue heads desperately gasping for oxygen. We got up with half our brains decayed and walked around the festival shivering, looking for an alternative plan. We were drawn like moths to a campfire where hashish was being passed around. We sat up with these long-haired kids till dawn, sharing their heat. The nicest was a guy our age who looked like Robert Plant. He seemed smarter and better informed than his American counterparts. August 12th. We walk by the river into the village to get a right fry-up in the pub. Some bikers come in, eye the crowd. One particularly nasty one comes over to me, picks up my pint with a smile, and drinks it down in one go. "Hey," I cry, "that's mine." "Oh, yeah?" he says, then proceeds to pick up my fried egg with his fingers, pops it in his mouth and swallows, looking me in the eye the whole time. Then he begins on my toast, sopping up the beans as he does. Everyone in the cafe is watching. Why is he picking on me? It gets very quiet. "Oh, that's all right, I guess," I say meekly to the Cro-Magnon man standing over me. "I reckon bikers get to have whatever they want." Back at the festival, Focus are playing their annoying prog rock, so we wander around looking at the crowd. We spot a fabulously pretty girl in knee-high silver boots, a white cotton skirt, white cotton top open to her bare and beautiful breasts, proudly sticking out, a circular shot of silver spray paint on each one. We kept leaping ahead of her to get more looks at this sexy moon maiden. Our new friends drop acid, and Kramer and I start on a quart of vodka. Electric Light Orchestra does a good set. Then it's time for Rod Stewart and the Faces. They're as drunk as we are. Rod is strutting around in the distance, a thumbnail shimmer of silver going back and forth as if on a conveyor belt, having a good old time. I see two of everything, two Rod Stewarts boxing effeminately across the stage. It's impossible to get back to the portable toilets, so we piss into empty beer cans, which we set down carefully, only to knock them over when we dance. Eventually, Kramer's passed out on the ground, and I go into a blackout. We get separated. I wander in the hordes, completely disoriented, like a waking dream. I think I am in a large interior space in Paris, on an escalator, no less. I sleepwalk into a large tent, which turns out to be the Salvation Army Medical Center. A nurse observes my confusion and leads me over to a cot and hands me a cup of hot, sweet tea and a bacon sandwich. She assumes I'm having some kind of severe acid trip. I'm coming around and then look at my neighbor on the next cot. It's Kramer. What are the chances of that in a sea of tens of thousands of people? We were lost, and now we are found. We make our way back to our friend's bonfire at the periphery of the mob. A teenage girl invites me to share a sleeping bag. in her pup tent. It sounds very cozy, but Kramer won't let me. He's sick and tired of girls going for me and ignoring him. He's his own worst enemy, though, if he wouldn't act so crazy all the time. August 13th, Day 3. Robert Wyatt's new group, Matching Mole Play. I love them. Then it's Roy Wood's Wizard, who look ridiculous but sound great. Headliners 10 years after finish off the day with Alvin Lee's interminable hyperfast amphetamine blues. Boring. Back to London for these two Minneapolis boys. August 18th. The fourth place we stay is near the Finchley Road. Mr. Stills, our landlord, brings us coffee and toast in the morning. We lie in our twin beds drawing and writing. Kramer laughs when he draws. We set off for the zoological gardens, where the animals are playing. Impressive penguins. Then, to Piccadilly Circus, and take in an adult double bill. School for Virgins and Girl Stroke Boy. Then, Ronnie Scott's. Then, the Speakeasy, where we hope to find rock royalty, or at least their groupies. We sit in the dark basement bar and eyeball a couple of likely-looking English lasses in their frock coats and bippity-boppity hats. Very Kensington High Street. They return our gaze with interest. We sidle on over and ask if we could buy them a drink. Their faces dropped. The prettier one says, in a honking New York accent, "They're Americans! Look, guys, if we were interested in your sort, we would have stayed in Long Island. Now fuck off!" "Aha! Imposters like us!" We refresh our weary stop-go streetlight city eyes and take the boat down to Kew, past Mick Jagger's house on Cheney Walk. In the big white Victorian greenhouse, we inhale deeply. A fragrant paradise. We walk through the bamboo and rhododendrons and take pictures of each other. The red-orange sun is slipping down into the horizon. On the boat trip back, we watch a middle-aged couple. We decided they were on the boat because they wouldn't run into any of their friends. They were married to others. He was holding her hand and looking into her eyes, all lovey-dovey, but she obviously had reservations about this adulterous affair. I suggested to Steve that I take their picture and blackmail them. We were acting it out, I being the outraged man. "Why, you little punk, you can't do that to me, blah, blah, blah." And Steve started laughing so hard that he was crying, and the couple forgot their melodrama to watch the strange kids on the bench facing them in a fit of hysterics. Bowie at the Rainbow, Finsbury Park. Drinking Pernod's in the pub across the way beforehand, gawking at the beautiful girls that look like beautiful boys. Inside, the crowd is insanely cool, milling about in the Art Deco lobby. The girls are dressed like 20s and 30s movie queens, lots of little Theda Baras and Jean Harlows. Roxy Music are the openers, who I've been reading about in the weeklies. Suave crooner Brian Ferry in a tiger skin jacket, and space alien Brian Eno in a feathered outfit, rock out their 50s futurist pop. Their single, Virginia Plain, has been blaring out of boutiques since we got here. They are noisy and energetic. At intermission, we drank vodka and Tia Maria's and wound up talking to a forward young girl named Mary with her friend Sharon. Mary had an ostrich feather thing around her neck. She announced that I was her gentleman escort, that I was pretty, and that she used me to forget about the bastard back home who slapped her. Mary said she liked effeminate boys, and I nudged her over to the doorway of the ladies' room and kissed her and felt up her tits. She had a long tongue. It was that kind of night. But the lights blinked on and off, and that meant showtime. In the concert hall, the speakers played Thus Spake Zarathustra. Two-level scaffolding at the back of the stage, smoke, projected stars revolving around the theater. Excitement. The spiders walk out in silhouette, and then the space invader himself. Very assured he was, too. He had a loud, clear voice that could go wherever he wanted it to. The Lindsay Kemp dancers did some lame mime in the background. It was theatrical. Bowie did many costume changes. The best part was the music itself, stripped down and dirty, playing those incredible songs. Bowie bare-legged and prancing about, mugging with Ronson in some kind of gay droogie thing. Up at the front, Mick Jagger was dancing in the aisles. It was totally thrilling, subversive. At the end, he sang Jacques Brel's My Death, alone with an acoustic guitar. Wow. Back in the lobby, Mary asked me to come home with her. What about my friend? Not him. Sharon doesn't like him. He asked her why she was so ugly. Just you, my gallant knight. Kramer gave me the fisheye, so I declined the offer. I saw the sweet secretary who had invited me into her sleeping bag in Reading and gave her a little wave. She looked sad. So we went off into the London night, the Katzenjammer kids in search of more beverages. We are accosted by a band of black kids who started picking at my camera, tugging at my clothes, asking for money, calling us fags. Kramer, never one to turn down a challenge, starts taunting them back, flying right into the eye of danger. It freaks them out and they scatter. August 21st, 1972, my 20th birthday. Goodbye to my teenage years. Although I still get carded to see if I'm 18, and occasionally asked whether I'm a boy or a girl. I've slept with 12 girls. Lainey slept with 12 boys. She and I have horniness in common. We go to the infamous Prospect of Whitby, 450 years old, in Wapping for a boozy birthday lunch of coq au vin, boiled potatoes, and peas, looking out over the dirty Thames. Home for a nap, then off to a drag bar we'd read about that's having a certain popularity with the glam set, the Black Cap. The performer is an old queen named Auntie Flo. She tells smutty jokes. We get picked up by a bunch of aging lechers led by drunken rock manager Kit Lambert, the Who, Hendrix, who says, I'm delightful and a superstar. And we simply must come with them to the after-hours marquee club because he has the key. So we pile in a van, and some geezer named Rocky kept trying to get me to squeeze his cock. What are you doing to young David Cassidy back there, Rocky? Leave the child alone, says Kit, who's got a posh accent. They're all extremely camp and very funny. We arrive and Kit opens the club up, and we loll about, soaking up the brandy. Then off to somebody's apartment on Haverstock Hill. The evening got very blurred at the edges. My near-rape experience. We went to see the play Sleuth, and after we were drinking gin and limes in a very crowded theater bar, I got to talking to a tall black West Indian guy named David. It was last call, 11 p.m., so we ordered doubles. David asked me about closing time in New York City, 4 a.m. What a shame it was we couldn't keep drinking, etc. He said we could all go to his place, where he had a fresh bottle of Johnny Walker. That is, if we wanted to. I said I'd ask my friend, who'd been talking to David's white friend. Kramer said, sure, why not? Another adventure. So we set off in two cars for the East End. In David's car, little MG, he was friendly in asking me about Kramer. Was he my lover? No, we're both straight, I said. Me too, he said. We drove on through dark, rainy streets. What an angel. You're really quite beautiful. Anyone ever told you that? And intelligent, too. I like you, he said, patting me on the knee. I like you, too, I said, beginning to get worried. Weird line of questioning. In the other car, the friend asked Kramer if we were lovers. He answered in the negative. But your friend is gay? He asked. No, he's not. He just looks that way. Then I think we might have a problem. David doesn't think he's gay, but he thinks Duncan is, and he just got out of prison for manslaughter. David can get violent, when he's refused.
What did he do?
Asked Kramer. He killed a boy. Meanwhile, we finally pull up at the curb of a dark, deserted street. David gets out and unlocks the door to a washing machine showroom and directs me in. Weird room, no lights, just a dozen washing machines. He ushers me to the back and opens a door to a flight of stairs. Up there, he says in a different tone of voice than before. Uh-oh. Now it's definitely creepy. He gives me a shove. I slowly ascend. The stairs open to a kitchen. David turns the light on, and I turn to look at his face. It's filled with hatred.
I guess our friends will be here soon. Hey, where's that scotch you mentioned? I said, trying to be normal.
I sat down at the kitchen table. He just glared at me, then got a bottle and set a juice glass in front of me, unscrewed the cap and started pouring. A few inches, then it started overflowing.
When? I said, trying to make light of it. You're spilling.
Drink it, he ordered.
What about you? Aren't you having one? I asked timidly.
With that, things sped up. He picked me up roughly by my shirt collar and said,
Let me show you my flat. This is my kitchen. This is my bathroom. This is my sitting room. And this, he bellowed, is my bedroom.
And with that, he hurled me across the room onto the bed. He flicked on the light and looked down at my cowering form.
You fucking little faggot cocktease. I hate little shits like you. Think you're so cute, don't you? Huh, don't you?
I'm sorry, you're right. I'll just go. I'm sorry I upset you, I said, getting up and making for the doorway. He swung at me and connected with my cheekbone. I saw stars. I began to scream.
Go ahead, you fucking little pansy. Scream all you want. No one can hear you, and I like it. Save your breath. This joint is soundproof.
With that, he grabbed me and forced me face down in the bed, all the while chanting a litany of things he was going to do, culminating with killing me. I believed him. I thought, so this is how it ends. All my hopes, all that promise, all my parents' love, just to be snuffed out by an angry maniac in some East End slum. He was very powerful, and he was trying to pull my blue jeans down, but I wouldn't cooperate, so then he'd hit me again with his enormous fist. My face was jammed into the mattress. At one point, he got out his cock, which was a Louisville Slugger, and said, Look at that! Is that what you wanted, huh? And I screamed, No! Till he slugged me again. I could taste blood and kept trying to writhe out of his grasp, but it was no good. I was in his nightmarish film, and he was going to have it his way, no matter what. My ass cheeks were now bared, but I wouldn't open my legs, and he was trying to wedge his cock up me with brute force. He's huffing and puffing. I felt it at my anus and clenched shut as hard as I could, screaming and kicking all the while. The other car pulled up outside. The guy said to Kramer, This could be bad. Just run up the back stairs, grab your friend, and run back down here. I'll stay with the motor running. Now go! Just in the nick of time, Kramer burst into the bedroom, acting like a drunken sailor, as if he was oblivious to the sexual assault taking place in the bed. He was singing I Love Paris at the top of his lungs and doing a stumble-bum dance, knocking over a lamp in the course of it.
Let's go. I gotta get up early tomorrow, says Kramer.
My assailant looked up, enraged, and tried to swat at him, but Kramer evaded his grasp. He kept up his inebriated song and dance routine, forcing David to get up to deal with him. I slid off the bed and scrambled out the bedroom door, Kramer right behind me, as David fumbled with his trousers screaming at us. Down the stairs, past the washing machines, and out into the waiting sports car with David in pursuit. The driver peeled out, David running behind the car trying to catch up. He threw rocks at us. I was out of breath and trembling from the terrifying experience. The driver dropped us off at a tube station, and we got on a train heading west. I finally collected myself.
You saved my life. That guy was gonna kill me.
Silence. Kramer eventually said, You stupid idiot.
Me? What was I supposed to do? They seemed all right. How was I supposed to know one of them was nuts?
Kramer told me the guy's story about manslaughter in prison, and then gave me the silent treatment for the next 12 hours. I tell him about the emotional distress I went through, and how since he's my best friend, I could use a little compassion. But he did save my life, so I let it go. It was a very close call. It never occurred to me to report the incident to the police. The next day I had a shiner and a split lip. We ate a solemn breakfast at Wimpy's. Living with Kramer for 3 weeks in London has been a strange experience, since he's such a strange guy. Sometimes incredibly warm and friendly, sometimes remote and volatile. He's got some troubled waters roiling below the surface. When he was 8, he was in a car crash in Colorado with his dad, who was killed, and Kramer was trapped in the car until the ambulance arrived. With his dead dad. I guess that'll do it. Did a number on his head. Kramer flew back to Minneapolis, leaving me alone for the remaining week. I sat in the dim glow of pubs reading Chandler, Smart Aleck, Kill, Pick Up on Noon Street, Spanish Blood, Nevada Gas. Went to a double feature, Au Pair Girls and The Seduction of Inga. Saw the pretty things again at the Roundhouse. Hung out in the supermodern South Bank complex. Saw a terrible show at the Hayward Gallery. No paintings, just information that came out of computers. A bad sign. Ate in the cozy lounge restaurant of the National Film Theater. Fresh greens and onions, pork sausages, coffee. Numerous double brandy and gingers. Vodka and limes. A Dubonnet on ice at midnight when a Peter Lorre festival began. 8-hour marathon devoted to the pop-eyed freak featuring M, the man who knew too much, arsenic and old lace, the beast with five fingers, and a comedy of terrors. I staggered out at dawn thoroughly Lorre-ized. Saw Bowie again at the Rainbow, even better the second time around. Incredible genius. During Starman, a glittering mirror ball cast stars over all of us. He played his new song, John, I'm Only Dancing, which was love at first hearing. I end my days at my local pub in Finchley, the North Star. Strike up a conversation with an affable, middle-aged Londoner. Closing time. We're walking along, chatting innocently, when I observe an interesting parking garage with bumper car balconies. It's kind of retro-futurism, I say, and he goes, Yes, follow me. It's even better inside. And my warning bell goes off again. He walks into the darkness, and I follow at a safe distance. I see him in a shadowy recess, with his cock out, and he's saying, Please, please, in a whimpery voice. I back up and say, You got it all wrong, pal, and set off to my sad bedsit to ruminate on why this whole city seems to be bent. I was walking down the old King's Road when I noticed a couple of 14-year-old schoolgirls following me. They seemed to be all a titter. They caught up with me at the corner where I was waiting on the light. Hello, I said with a smile. They burst into giggles, and then one extended a copy of the new Rolling Stone, which featured David Cassidy on the cover, lying back in the grass, his chest exposed. Would you sign this for me? Asked the breathless girl. Of course, darling. What's your name? Sheila, she said with a fresh salvo of giggles. I got out my trusty wide-tip rapidograph and wrote, To Sheila, all my love, David, XXOO, right over his stomach and handed it back to her. She stared at it with awe, then looked up at me as if I was the second coming. Thank you. We love you, she managed to get out. Then, unable to contain themselves, they ran off screaming. Oh, to be a pop star. Time to go back to the USA. September 5th, 1972. Had to spend the night in the TWA terminal, as my train to Bar don't leave until morning. Sopped up as many Black Russians as I could before the bar closed. Slept on a bench, cab to Grand Central, then dozed on the train up to Hudson. When I get there, I unpack my gear in my top-floor single room in ivy-covered Hobson. Felt like being in a treehouse. Nice windows with old leaded frames. Right across from the Greek Revival Library. Then, went down to swill some of the free Pabst Blue Ribbon from a beer truck that's parked on Stone Row. Followed Dupre down to his new room, and some guys handing out free scotch. I had a lot of it. I passed out, and was woken up to go down the road for some drinks. At this point, I'm in kind of a waking dream. On the way, I became convinced that Dupre was taking me off to rub me out. All that Raymond Chandler stuck in my subconscious. I took a swing at him and gave him a fat lip and a sore chin. But he was good-natured about it. Took me to a dance where I sat passed out in a chair for 3 hours. Dupre got me to my room with some difficulty. He lives on the floor below me. I woke up in the morning, fully dressed, with no idea where I was, or even what country I was in. I looked in the corner of my room, and there was a naked boy crouched with his back to me. Oh, God, who is it? What have I done now? I said, "Hello?" tentatively. He didn't move. I got up and walked over to him, and gently touched him on the shoulder. He slowly turned to face me, and looking up into my eyes with a forlorn expression was me.
Ah!
I raced out of the room wondering if I'd somehow suffered a psychic split. A bad omen. I was shuddering with the shock of it all. My pores were secreting booze. I need a lobotomy. Welcome to a new term of higher education. There's a cute freshman with frosted hair who I think is a rock chick. I was wrong. She's a fashion chick. I wonder what her name is. It's Hazel. She's from Philly. Sparkly eyes like Shirley MacLaine's. She raps in my door about midnight. I'm smoking cigs with Dupre and listening to Matching Mole, Oh Caroline. She's wearing a filmy two-piece number. She stays a couple of hours and gets me to promise to take a walk with her tomorrow. Next evening, she shows up looking like a Tootsie Pop in high-waisted yellow pants and a striped mambo wrapper. We go to Haunted Blythewood, sit by the fountain, listening to the burbling noises coming out of Eris's mouth. She asks if I have any romantic attachments. We wander back holding hands, this concentrated progression of two would-be lovers. We go to her room, around the bed, looking at a copy of Vogue. Then she turns off the light and lies down, back to me. I reach around and fondle her excited nipples. Hearts beating left and right, we're both saying the sweetest things, all this build-up. And I roll her over and look down at her freckled face with her heavy Cleopatra-lidded eyes and glistening mouth ready to kiss. We do. Her pelvis starts going into an involuntary grind. Heat emanates from her. Next comes naked. Off goes her op art undies. In goes me, Duncan and Hazel all night long. In the morning, she says, I fuck like an enthusiastic little boy. She had an affair with a 32-year-old man. She's 18, so I guess she should know. Weekend in New York. Parents staying at the Waldorf. Dad hands me a double scotch and says, here, maybe this'll loosen your tongue. We went to the Rainbow Room in the top of the Sixes, Dad's eyes twinkling at all the attractive girls. I held my mom's hand on Avenue of the Americas and told her she was beautiful and kissed her on the nose. My clique at the Bard Dining Commons consists of poet Doc Bray, who has a deeply indented chest and mad eyes, says he will be up there with James Joyce by the time he's 35. Then there's Jim Gardiner, also a poet, full of insults, each one more disgusting than the last. Losing friends fast, holds up a broken glass and says, "Here, want a drink? It tastes better before I sat on it." Then there's John Browner from White Plains, into dance and yoga, talks in hippie jargon, far out, dig this, bummer. Washes his ponytail with Physohex. We drink gallons of coffee and smoke endless cigarettes. There's a musician from down the hall named Richard Edson, who looks like a squint-eyed Bowery boy. Talks like one, too. Sometimes we are joined by Herb Ritz, who grew up in Beverly Hills next door to Steve McQueen. Once Herb gave me a doleful look and said he'd like to be my sugar daddy. He's got a boyfriend named Chuck who looks like Troy Donahue. Then my best pal, handsome Rob Dupre from D.C., whose dad ran off with their French maid. He sent Dupre off to Stockbridge boarding school with 100 other drug addicts. He's as hilarious as Bugs Bunny. Some kid comes up to our dinner table and points at the salt shaker with his index finger and says, "Does anyone want to use this?" And Dupre says, "Sure, thanks," and grabs the guy's finger and uses it to pick his nostril. The kid retreats in a state of shock. Another time, Dupre asks Peter Putnam, a tweety, horn-rimmed philosophy major, who tells us frequently that he's going to kill himself, if he would pass the salt. Putnam says, "I don't believe in salt." Dupre says, "Well, whether or not you believe in salt, it exists. Now pass the fucking salt." Then there's my Moll Hazel, who's got a $3 Gene Seberg haircut at the barbershop in Red Hook. Very becoming to her lovely bone structure and garbo eyes. Hazel says she doesn't know who she is, a common malady for a college freshman. Down to Manhattan to see the New York debut of David Bowie. Carnegie Hall, no less. The joint is packed, decked out in full glam regalia. This situation calls for Pernod. Angela Bowie is swanning around with some Warholian riffraff. Eric Lee is dressed as a droog, all white with black boots and suspenders. There's 20-year-old Johnny Thunders, lead guitarist with the New York Dolls, swathed in multiple silk scarves, white leather jacket, and rooster cut. Dupre goes over to Johnny, puts his arm around him, smiles threateningly into his hawk-like face, and says, "Hi, pal." Johnny loses his cool composure. It's all about to happen. Dupre and I have our chins on stage. The Clockwork Orange soundtrack is blaring. The strobe light's going, and out comes Carrot Top Ziggy, spacesuit sleeves rolled casually to his elbows. Snow-white tan, so pale he's luminous, holding a dozen roses. "I'm an alligator," he sings, holding his fingers up to his different-colored eyes like goggles. "Do it again, do it again." He gives snarling Mick Ronson a passing caress. He blows his lines with laughter. It's sharp and menacing and cruel fun. Look at those cavemen go. A tear runs down his face and leaves a mascara trail. At the encore, autographed photos drop from the ceiling that say, "I love you, David, XXXX. Oh, that this night would last forever. Next day we wake up with pounding heads in the kindergarten playroom we crashed at on 33rd Street. Hungover, but happy. We drink some V8 juice and aspirin. Take the bus down to Paul McGregor's unisex hair salon, where big-busted Linda will give me a chop. She likes me. Her tits accidentally on purpose grazing me repeatedly, snipping away, giving me a spiky lunar punk bulldyke monkey cut. Dupre went for a Jeff Beck shag. We get out, checking our reflections in the store windows. We talk in exaggerated homosexual accents, lips pursed and pop-eyed at our peacock foppery. Dupre says there were 50 murders in one day in New York City last week. There's a setting in my camera for apocalypse lighting. Blythewood Ghost Story, Part 2. Jimmy Clifford is here from Lake Forest College visiting sexy tomboy Jenny Brown.
I bump into them playing jacks in front of the dining commons. "Jimmy!" I cry. I tell him I'm looking forward to seeing more of him this weekend. He whispers to me that it's unlikely because he's here on a mission of love. It's going to be all Jenny, all the time. "Okay, I understand," I said with a wink. Jenny then told me that she didn't like me and had no interest in getting to know me. "But we have the same bushy eyebrows," I joked. Jenny don't like herself either, so anyone who loves her, like Jimmy, must be fucked up. Anyway, I went to the film that night, Dr. Strangelove, which scared the shit out of me. I went back to my dorm thinking about Armageddon and found somber Jimmy sitting on my bed, dressed in a brown hooded sweatshirt, listening to Pavane for a Dead Princess by Ravel, my only classical record. He'd lit a couple of candles. I sat next to him, just two Blake boys, a long way from home. "What's up, Jimmy? Where's Jenny?" "Jenny's in love with some guy named George," he said glumly. I was afraid of that. I've seen him together. He's a big idiot. I suggested we go down the road to drink many, many pitchers of beer and drown his sorrows. He didn't respond. I'd never seen him like this. Not in the 13 years I'd known him, my oldest friend. Not on any of the acid trips we'd taken together, staring up at the starry galaxies together. Why, Jimmy laughed at the cosmos. Jimmy could roll with the punches, yet here he was, broken-hearted and funereal. His eyes were unfocused. He was unresponsive. Suddenly, he got up and left. "Jimmy," I yelled, "wait up." I snuffed the candle out, turned off the KLH, and ran downstairs after him. Now, Jimmy didn't know the layout of the sprawling campus, having limited himself to the center thus far. But he was behaving as if he knew it like the back of his hand, walking very fast over fields, taking shortcuts in the westerly direction of the river. I was not far behind, struggling to keep up, trying to grab his shoulder, yelling out, "Jimmy, you're going the wrong way. The bar is that way. Jimmy, stop!" To no avail. He was like a man possessed, proceeding in a fixed course under the glowering autumnal sky. "My God, he's going to Blythewood," I thought. A place he's never been, and yet there was no hesitation in his single-minded route. Sure enough, he got to the long driveway and sped towards the entrance, under the white columns and through the front door. He'll be distracted by the students milling about and snap out of it, I thought. But no, he zoomed right past them, up the grand staircase to the second floor, down the hallway, to the unmarked door to the attic, flung it open, and ascended. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. This was not the Jimmy I knew anymore. I followed him up into the attic, where poor Mrs. Zabriskie hanged herself 70 years ago. The atmosphere up there was oppressive. It was dark and very loud, with the kind of white noise you hear in a jet engine. The sound of whirring energy, psychic noise. Jimmy had gone to the center of the room, where an old ladder led up to a trapdoor to the roof. He started to climb. I crossed to the base of it and yelled, "Jimmy!" over the din of the place. I looked up and saw him fling open the hatch, saw the stormy purple and gray sky scudding by overhead, saw him lift himself up, and then heard him scream. Then he was up and out. To do what? Jump? I scrambled up after him, pulled my head through the trap, and looked around, fearing the worst. I felt a great relief when I saw him leaning over the railing, sobbing. I sensed he was himself again. I relaxed. Just as I did, I felt 4 very cold fingers pass over my neck, a kind of icy caress. I leapt up with a rush of fear-induced adrenaline and joined Jimmy at the railing. He was in a hysterical state, breathing heavily. "Dunk! I don't know where I am. Something just grabbed me by the neck.
I know, Jimmy. She grabbed me, too. We gotta get out of here. Let's go back down.
I can't go back in there. That's where it grabbed me.
I know, but it's the only way out. Let's get it over with. You first. So down we went, pulling the trapdoor shut over us. The psychic roar of the attic was louder than ever. But we were gone in a matter of seconds. Down through the dorm, the girls giving us funny looks. Out the door and into the blustery night air. Jimmy said, "The last thing I remember was being in your room after Jenny dumped me. I don't know how I got here." "You were summoned. Somebody felt your pain." I told him the whole story as we walked down to Adolph's. It didn't fit into Jimmy's scheme of things. He had no room in his life for ghosts, and yet he couldn't explain it. We got royally drunk. Meanwhile, Hazel has given me my walking papers and taken up with a handsome bisexual artist who makes cool sculptures out of chrome car bumpers. He loves Motown. Loved me last year. Can't say I mind. I paint in the studios at night, trying out the abstract expressionism I dig so much. De Kooning, Twerkov, early Alfred Leslie. Trying to get my painting to grow from the inside, fighting the inclination to design an abstract picture and fill it in. It's hard. I'm using acrylics, which are after all just plastic. They look shrill to me. I leave the dirty stain of my charcoal underdrawing visible to give it a little bite. Put a color down, study how its power is controlled by the colors next to it, all over painting, turning it this way and that. Afterwards, I toddle off to Adolph's to meet Dupre, who's got beautiful blonde Alice Wilcox cooing by his side. We all get drunk, and Alice asks us to take her back for a menage a trois. God bless her dirty mind. Through the haze of alcohol, I can just barely remember Dupre slowly undressing her like a doll, watching her plump pink lips filleting him. He looked like a wolf. She looked like Bardot. We all kissed each other a lot. I don't think I was good for much, boner-wise. Irish droop, whiskey willy. In Red Hook one night with the fellas. As we left the old movie theater and walked past the gas station, a townie stopped me and said, "Hey, why are you so queer?" "Because I like it," I shot back. "You really do?" he asked incredulously. Then there was an explosion in my head as his unseen fist crashed into my nose. I toppled over, then slunk off, but he and his cronies followed me. My pals came to the rescue. Gardner, Boris, Dupre, and Werner. My valiant knights. It was a real Western showdown. After the face-off with the grease monkeys, we took off in Werner's old Pontiac with the illuminated orange Indian head hood ornament. It's Sunday morning, and I'm sitting in Dupre's room after a shower in the basement, where we used Wella balsam on our hair. Nice smell. We're listening to a bit of Bach and talking about the film If, which we dug so much. Like the part where McDowell kept putting on the Sanctus from Miss Aluba over and over. I tell him about an Excelsior kid I knew who was hallucinating on belladonna all night, comes home, sees his mom hanging from a rafter, all blue in the face. He thinks, "Wow, weird," and goes to bed. Next morning, she was still there, did herself in. My pal went off to the night house, never to be seen again. Trouble. A panicky long-distance phone call tells me that a complication has arisen in my charmed life. Lainey is 9 weeks pregnant with our baby. On August 7th, her parents dropped her off at my house about 10. She wanted to have a farewell fuck so I could remember what I was missing when I was in London. We went up into the loft and turned the TV up so my parents couldn't hear us. Lainey told me her period was starting tomorrow, so she was safe. My mother interrupted in her nightgown. She couldn't see us, saying, "Don't stay up too late." Anyhow, it was a special shag, unlike anything we'd experienced before. We both came together and both heard bells ringing. It felt momentous. Lainey said she remembered thinking, "That one did it." Now our pleasures have caught up with us. Time to pay the piper. Of course, the poor girl is scared to death. Says she's in hell and filled with bad thoughts. She was brought up Catholic. She's still in high school. She's depending on me to get her out of this mess. My responsibility. I need $250. I had 45, borrowed 60 from Browner, 25 from Dupre. Jesus Christ, a human being. Dupre says he'll take the baby and have him playing guitar in a couple of weeks. I think of Carol Lindley in Blue Denim. I think of Steve McQueen and Natalie Wood in Love with the Proper Stranger. I contact Planned Parenthood about abortion clinics, against the law in Minnesota. I eventually wire Lainey $150. She borrows the rest. Another wild night. Got drunk on Lowenbrow in the gym where a band was playing Todd Rundgren covers. Alice Wilcox drags me off to the bar for some stingers, telling me that I have the mind of Kierkegaard.
What?
She's given to that kind of existential malarkey. But her mouth is like Bridget Bardot's, so I concentrate on that. At 2:30, the lights go on, and Alice and I make that long walk back to campus. I'm suffering from alcoholic psychosis and bolt into the woods. She can't find me, so she goes to Dupre's room to enlist some help, wakes him up. He says, "A dead Duncan is better than a tired Rob," and goes back to sleep. An hour later, he hears her dragging me up the stairs, beetle boots banging, me talking gibberish. I wake up at noon and find her naked in bed with me, smoking a cigarette. "I found you in the mailroom," she says proudly. My heroic nurse. Dupre said of her, "Well, she may not be smart, but she sure is stupid." October 27, 1972. Lainey flies into NYC, takes the train up to Rhinecliff. I spy her gorgeous self sitting on a bench in the waiting room, under the yellow insect lights. Off to Adolph's, then back to my room for our last night of fornication. Finally, a temporary room of our own, not a laundry room or a locked bathroom or a briefly borrowed bedroom. She's 12 pounds heavier, with swollen tits laced with delicate blue veins that weren't there before. Our lovemaking goes through 3 records on the turntable, Roxy Music, Space Oddity, and a Blue Note LP. We climax during an Art Blakey drum solo. Abortion morning. Raining, of course. Leave at dawn. Lloyd has agreed to drive us down to the Central Women's Center on Lafayette Street in Manhattan. I squeeze Lainey's hand on the 2-hour ride in Lloyd's Blue Beetle. When we delivered her, they herded her and the rest of the unwed mothers in like cattle. Lloyd and I walked the 9 a.m. streets, past the junky scarecrows, crazy hopheads, panhandlers, drunks with their hats on backwards, some weirdies, some queeries, some filthies, some newies, some oldies. Vapor rising from manholes like hot breath. Eagles leaning over the parapets of the gleaming Chrysler building. There's more challenge here in NYC. I'm overprotected at Bard. This is a normal day for most people. My child's short but brilliant career ends in 1 hour. We were wrong, but so in love, flits through my mind. We picked Lainey up at 2 p.m., her uterus completely vacuumed out. Much relief all around. After the 50 acid trips this girl had taken from 8th grade on, what would she have given birth to? A fish? Stan Laurel? Dear thing, I ouch for you. Back on campus, we sit through Red Desert by Antonioni, starring the ridiculously beautiful Monica Vitti. Lainey's bored out of her mind by it. Halloween party in the gym. Lainey went as the kid, backwards newsboy cap and blacked out front tooth. I went as Egon Sheila. We went back to my room and lay around talking. She wants to be an anesthesiologist or a Vogue model. Finally, we have a room of our own with no parents. We can't have full-on sex. So we try out the moves adolescents do. We want to make the best out of this unfortunate situation. A 2 a.m. blowjob, followed shortly thereafter by another. Lots of thrillingly dirty acts. A whole week of heavy petting, as the high school guidebook calls it. Over there, across the room, flopped in the single bed, Lainey's licking her salty lips, underneath a poster of a gorilla, merrily carrying off a laughing brunette, wearing nothing but silver dance shoes. I've never lived with her, or any girl, 24 hours a day. What is she thinking? She doesn't talk much. She's a mystery. She's butch, like a bratty boy. Childishly apes my clever sayings. But then she's back and lovey-dovey again. Doctor said she couldn't travel for a week, so here she is, frustrated at not being able to fuck. That's one thing that gives her confidence. When asked what abstraction means to him, de Kooning tells a story about an old Armenian man who used to pick up free stale bread. De Kooning followed him to his house to see what he did with it all, peered in his window. The guy crumbled it onto his floor to use as a carpet. De Kooning said, "I remember he had a very abstract look on his face." Thanksgiving in Minneapolis. This house is the length of my dad's old subchaser. Watched The Counterfeit Trader and Marriage Italian Style on TV. A novelty since I don't have a TV at school. Went to a party at Angie's new apartment on Fremont Avenue, covered with posters of Bowie and Bolan. Drank a bottle of rum, argued with Lainey, called Dad to say I wouldn't be home, and woke up with Angie. Strong sunlight streaming in. Hangovers always make me horny. Technically, we're both sworn to others, but she was looking slim and beautiful and being very naughty, tugging on my sex hairs, so we made illicit love. Took a bath, then went back to bed for another bout in the perfumed garden. Something delicious about sex with your ex. Back to Bard, listening to Messiaen's Tarangulila Symphony, clicking its incisors, one of Jack Bruce's favorites. And Joni Mitchell sings, "It's the unknown child, so sweet and wild. It's youth. It's too good to waste." Youth is more aware of division than of continuity. Youth cult must be served. Drawing is a way of learning to see, a way of reasoning on paper. I'm striving to do it with ease and simplicity. I've got a long way to go. Androgynous Chinese pal Eric Lee comes to visit me at Bard from Columbia, where he studies concert piano. We started drinking about noon, wandering around the snowy landscape in our rock and roll clothes. Some girl asked me, "What is the sex of your friend?" "Male," I answer. Eventually, he got picked up by a pretty girl named Emily. I woke up at 4 a.m., sleeping next to a trash barrel. Feeling a little unwell now. Went down to the cellar shower room, lay in the cold floor, and let the hot water splash all over my skull. December 15th, 1972. Read Straight as the Gate by Gide and Nightwood by Djuna Barnes. I've done 11 canvases in the last 3 months, none that I'm satisfied with. It's back to Minneapolis for Christmas. Dad and I go skiing. Sitting in the chairlift, Dad is worried because I don't know about economics or electricity or insurance or nothing. So I tell him that he doesn't know what I know, and if I'm going to make it as an artist, I gotta be really good. And maybe the fun is in getting there. I'm not worried about money. I'll figure something out on the way. Then he gives me a lecture on Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, a book he swears by. Ask strangers questions, win them over. He makes me ride the chairlift with strangers to practice the Dale Carnegie technique. Pretending to be fascinated by utter bores is my idea of hell. Do you drink in the day? Do you drink alone? Do you drink to feel better? Do you ever forget what you did when you were drunk? Okay, all right, yes to all of these. My uncle tells me it's all right to drink, but it's never all right to get drunk. Where's the fun in that, I'd like to know. I wonder what my liver looks like these days. My body is my laboratory. One of the things is, drinking facilitates adventures, especially of the erotic variety. It's like entering an alternate universe where anything goes. The night is up for grabs. The Lainey and Angie Chronicles continued. Lainey and Angie are best friends. We're in a triangle, a tug of war, back and forth. Angie wears sexy schoolgirl clothes. Angie and I pretend we're Nick and Nora Charles, which leads to bed. Of course, this makes Lainey mad and she threatens us with all kinds of punishment. She prides herself on her hot temper, loves drama. When she sees something in my eyes that doesn't spell her name, she goes nuts. Very narcissistic. I think of that song, How Could You Believe Me When I Said I Love You When You Know I've Been a Liar All My Life? A dirty, stinking liar at that. Boys will be boys. We're all keen on the new Lou Reed album, Transformer. He's jumped onto the glam bandwagon. Satellite of Love is pretty great. And Gigolo Ant by Syd Barrett is sublime. January 1st, 1973, Washington, D.C. My parents shipped me off to my sister's for the barred field period, thinking it would be safer than letting me stay in Minneapolis with my gang and all. Unforeseen dangers, they called it. Remember, we're working for you, not against you, said my dad. Mom says, I hope you marry a rich girl. It's the only hope you've got. You're the most impossible human being I have ever known in my life. It's good, a new inner city to explore. Holly and Bars live in a nice 100-year-old, three-story, redstone row house, 646 East Capitol Street, with a basement I can use as my studio. The nocturnal pink glow that comes in the bay window is from the crime lights. D.C. is a very black city. I'm listening to Grant Green's Street of Dreams to get myself in the right mood, reading Sartre's Intimacy, which is just like an angsty French movie, riding the bus to DuPont Circle to buy a sack of records, thinking about all those brown-skinned people's lives. Dupre's at his mom's in Rock Creek Park, so he picks me up, and we hope to get in trouble just so we can get out of it again. We drive past Lafayette Park, the Capitol, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial, all spotlit at night and silent. We hang out at a rock club in Georgetown called Apple Pie, peopled with glamour pusses, flash guitar slingers in black mesh and python boots, gays with hennaed hair and platform sandals, scarlet women with tits like hunting horns, rolling their eyes like planets, legs opening and closing at will. 6'5" vultures with colored beaks and bangles. We try another teen club called Your Mother's Place and learned that Roxy played a set there 3 nights ago. We were crushed. The greaser crowd didn't even like them. Another one called Pier 9, multi-leveled, spacious, and mostly gay, pretty wild in there. I met a beautiful girl called Jenna Weefa, who has a high, breathy voice and big knockers that don't really go with the rest of her waif-like persona. She's 26, and she's from Germany. Not only did she see Roxy 3 nights ago, but she slept with Eno. She told me I was pretty, looked French, and was just a kid. She gave me her phone number. And the dance floor's pounding crocodile rock. put in a 10-hour painting day in my makeshift basement studio, then went off bar hopping with Dupre. Went to a sleazy strip bar filled with Marines. One dancer toyed with me.